start this next 40 minutes giving Paul and John a chance to respond to that excellent, excellent engagement.
I told them this already. I thought that was the best conversation I've ever had seen these two have. And I've watched all of them online that you two have done, and I've watched them closely. There was so much that you two touched on, so much you worked through, and actually it was funny, I was if y'all haven't met the Lowry boys, I know Ken has his own channel, he's easy to spot, but his brother and his brother-in-law are here too, and they're wonder. I've been giving them a ride back and forth to the hotel, and it's been wonderful because just watching Dialogos in a family is incredible. What was I going to talk about? Do you remember? Spirit of finesse. When you two were talking about, I've just seen the maturing of the Dialogos between you two, and you know, my channel started sort of me as a nosy person butting in, and I can do that via videos without offending people, hopefully, too much. But you know, the idea, John, that you've really helped us understand through cognitive science that, you know, I've long talked about a consciousness congress, and in fact, all of you, or especially all of you, but some of you out there too, Jacob, Grizz, Chad, whole bunch of you, through this crazy thing of YouTube, I've, you know, Father Eric, there's another one, you know, I've got pieces of you in me, and we do that. And your point about virtue, and you said, you know, almost the Greek gods, this to me was what I'm always trying to get at with the spirit of finesse versus the spirit of geometry, that we go into a personal mode, and I think that gets beyond just the propositional, gets into all the four P's imaginally. I loved your explanation today about the imaginal and how you talked about the fact that without the imaginal, the stage itself is imaginal to us. I think often when people hear you talk about the imaginal, they're, you know, I know that you've gotten a lot of criticism with the way you use language with what I think, you know, the biggest gift you're giving us is this new language that you are inventing, and it is inventio.
Thank you.
And I thought, you know, it's a steep slope for a lot of people to pick all this up as we go, but given time, it is being picked up. And I think we are working on, you know, what I'm trying to get at with God number one and God number two is very much this way, that you have to go into this mode if you're actually going to inhabit and participate and do something analogous to walking across the stage. And of course, wisdom in, you know, wisdom is Sophia in the book of Proverbs, wisdom is a lady. And, you know, I thought you two, you went through a lot of stuff quickly, so I might have to make like three videos on what you guys did this morning because you covered a lot of ground, but I thought you both connected with each other, found each other, really challenged each other, and it was beautiful. I thought a lot of the stuff that we've been working on over the last 3-4 years sort of gelled this morning. And I think probably the two of you, if you decide to watch the recording, will be able to see what the rest of us saw. So it was, I thought it was, yeah, I think it was an achievement born on, I think what is beneath all of this, which is relationship. It's that you two have built trust, and it's not just a matter of these propositions coming out on stage, but bringing who you are, and then it was also deeply personal. So I applaud you both. It was wonderful.
Yeah, I don't actually agree with Paul on everything always. In this case, I would say that perhaps the greatest gift you gave us this morning was not the language that you offer up, the shared language, but modeling the respect and the towardliness and the way that you take each other serious and that you listen very carefully. I'm going to say this again later on today, but I'm a bit of a one-trick pony. So even though I'm not quite ready to replace the church with the estuary, I am nevertheless going to again say that what you did was you helped all the estuary leaders in this room. By the way, there are 20 of them. This is the kind of thing, this video even, they can use and say, okay, so you want to know what an estuary conversation looks like? That's what it looks like. So that's how you get yourself out of the way. That's how you walk right up to the edge of that cliff. And that's how you trust each other to hold each other with value and with respect. And so I would say that, yes, that would be my judgment. That was the greatest gift that you gave us this morning. So sorry, Paul, you were wrong.
Well, and I think where you sort of left off, one of the things that has been very helpful for me, and Jordan Peterson has really contributed a lot to this, is I think bringing back, I'd say reintegrating for us the understanding of the place of worship. And I think attention, aspiration, and the imaginal, those things come together very much in worship. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, one of the big fights between, let's say, the Protestants and the Roman Catholic, embedded in some in the Heidelberg Catechism, for example, was the question, well, what's actually going on in that Mass? You know, and I think, John, your contribution of the imaginal is very helpful in terms of understanding the sacramental. And Jonathan, you're drawing our attention to attention itself has an understanding and being able to sort of weave that into, well, why do we go to this room? And why do we sing those songs? And why do we do these things? I think what that's doing is helping people see, okay, and understand this is the role, and hopefully in a way that doesn't sort of exhaust it in a functional way. Oh, I need to go and do this, or an instrumental way, in order to accomplish this. And again, I think that's part of the reason why it's a rather odd thing for me as a pastor, because I certainly pay a lot of attention to you two, but I really try to pay a lot of attention to these guys because they're really where my interest lies, because I'm a pastor. And so it's always a mystery when I listen to, and I ask a lot of questions, well, how has Jonathan helped you? And it's really hard for people to articulate that often. And what has John done for you? And it's hard for people to articulate, but you know, watching what you two did here and sort of piecing together with respect to attention, aspiration, embodiment. I know I might embarrass you guys, but you can be embarrassed now and then. I think that's a tremendous contribution that you've made. And for me, part of the reason for doing an event like this is it's really cool to watch you guys do it on YouTube. But to do it in a physical space here with not just imagined attention because you're looking at a camera, but the real attention of the people in the room, it's a totally different thing. And I think it's profoundly important. So
I definitely see the difference between having in-person discussions and YouTube. You know, although the YouTube discussions are great, there is something, I don't know, it's hard to explain it, but there's something magical that happens when you're actually with someone, you know, and you can see, you catch all the these little micro things that you don't think about, that it just, definitely. And it is true that, like having everyone here, I was surprised to what extent I saw all of you as a participant in the discussion. Usually, it might not be the most obvious way that I would do that, but I was kind of looking at you as a collective intelligence or something, and like, you know, what do you think? So I was trying to get the opinion of the people watching as well. It's a strange experience.
Yeah, I agree. For me, it's something like that. I wish I could do everything in person. As you can see, I move around differently in person than I do. If I did that on the TV, like John's off camera. Like when I was filming after Socrates, they had all these cameras set up in different locations, and they still were saying, "Stand within this area," right? And then for me, it's—I mean this as a compliment, so I hope it's taken that way. You become like the Greek chorus in one of the great tragedies. There's the protagonist and the antagonist, and they're right, and you're not the antagonist. You know what I mean, right?
Right.
But the Greek chorus is there, and they are shaping and changing and reflecting on, and it's a very powerful experience.
Well, I think about Plato, broad wrestling, even Fight Club, and even though, you know, we're not here. I don't have the right word for it. It's sparring in a sense, in that when you spar, you're certainly not looking to disable the other, but you are testing each other's strength, and you're testing your own. And the fact that, you know, 1999 produced both The Matrix and Fight Club says something about our need again to embody. And to what you two do for us is you're feeding our consciousness congress, and you're helping us do this process. And John, I thought yesterday with your talk, you know, it was terrific in terms of understanding the internal and the external and going back and forth. And now I'm going to say things that may get me in trouble, but you know, there's a lot of the tension. You know, one of the things that we wrestled with in putting together this group was we have too many Christians. So I don't know what to think about Vindonk, but I'm going to talk about him tomorrow during my sermon. But I think it's but again, I think it's vitally important for us to, John, you keep us honest in ways that church people sometimes struggle with. And you do so in a way that's humble, it's generous, and I think that's part of the reason why I'm so grateful for your presence here. Thank because you. Of how you bring yourself. So
thank you for that.
Maybe this isn't dialogos enough, but I, you know, again, I just, what happened this morning was great.
I want you to hear that it's the same for me. I love, and I need to be in genuine, good faith dialogos with people that are within religious traditions. It keeps me properly oriented towards religion in a way that is essential to the project I see myself engaged in. I wish I could, and I do, but I wish I could more frequently talk like this in good faith with Muslims and Jews. I do when I can. I never refuse it when it's offered. You offer more. And also, you know, Buddhists. But I've had a long dialogue with Buddhists, so that's not as pressing to me right now. So this is very valuable to me. Very valuable. You're valuable to me. Important. So, yeah, it's definitely reciprocated.
Yeah, for sure. The thing that I, because while we're having the discussion, you probably noticed that I was going right to the edge of what I think, like just right to the point where I'm not sure, like in experimental land where I'm not sure, and I'm thinking, you know, in some ways I'm exposing myself because you could have poked, and I'm like, well, actually, I'm trying to formulate this, right? You could have poked and you could have just, but in some ways I think that the style of our discussion makes it that you kind of pull me along and you'll pull me even further. Then when you'll see that I'm on stable ground, then maybe you'll poke a bit, and that's what I want, right? So it's great to have a conversation like that, because in some ways, you're not obviously not like a yes man that's just going to agree with everything I say, no. But I can feel like you're trying to make it, you're trying to bring the conversation further, you know. And if you need to make my point stronger to do that, then yeah. And if sometimes you need to poke back, then fine. And it, yeah, so I hope that I'm doing something similar, but I can at least see you doing it to me, that's for sure.
Thank you for saying that. So for me to give credit, that's what I am learning from Socrates. He talked about following the logos the way you follow the wind, right? And of course that would resonate with Christians. I aspire to do that. I do feel that you are you're accompanying me on that extremely well. I love being in discussion with you, and when the dialogos catches, those are some of the best moments of my life. Yeah. So yeah, very much.
Thanks, John. And everybody, stay tuned, because we need to have a conversation about AI.
Yes,
very
soon.
We're
going to record
if you've all watched his video that he's been putting out, I've been seeing it at home, like trying to reach into the screen.
There are ways to do that, John.
Like, yeah, it's like, yeah. The ring or whatever. So yeah.
Well, to start pulling in some questions from the crowd. Is Mr. Miyagi a useful imaginal saint we could learn from Karate Kid?
Which version? First or second?
Definitely first.
How useful is practice before seeing? Wax on, wax off.
So I guess I should talk first because I'm the martial artist in the group.
Yeah.
So first of all, just the general point, I forget the person I was talking to, so please forgive me. I do think, and Rafe Kelly and I have done work around this, and some of you may have seen those videos, and Rafe is an astonishing human being. But we need to recover, maybe reinventio, a deeper discussion between the martial arts and philosophy, properly understood as the cultivation of wisdom, not the academic enterprise of meta-critique and meta-reflection, which is in its own right a good thing to do. People keep, well, you know, like, I am an academic, come on. I think that's really important. And Plato was a wrestler, and Socrates was literally a warrior. And to forget that, and that's his Rafe's point, is to miscontextualize them. We do this wrong thing. We contextualize them within academia. And right, the academy is next to the gymnasium, and the gymnasium is near the sacred shrine. That's the context that they should be put in order to properly understand them. And I think a deeper discussion about between philosophy and martial arts, I think, would be extremely valuable, especially if you find some of the points that myself and all the four ECOG side people are making about the importance of embodiment, embeddedness in action. So just that, I think, is important. I do think that doing these practices made available to me certain ways of taking a stance, of oriented my comportment, that enabled me to get to where I am. I related before, and I use it as one of my primary example of a practice. I'm trying to make a distinction I've lost his name right now. It'll come to me. he makes a distinction between a practice, which you do on your own, and a ritual is something you do with other people. And I think that's right. The interesting thing about Tai Chi is it's both, because you practice it on your own, but you will also do it with other people, especially when you're going through the long period of the education. And I do remember the way, when I was in grad school, I'd been doing Tai Chi like religiously for about 3 or 4 years, and people were coming to me and saying, what's happened, you're different. And it's like, what do you mean I'm different? And it's like, well, you're much more balanced, you're much more flexible, you're more into the give and take. And I of course was like everybody else who's first learning, you get all caught up in all the weird and wonderful phenomenology. Like there's times when you're as hot as fire and as cold as ice and all this stuff. Oh, I'm going to be a Buddha soon and all that crap. And that all dies away. And then I got that. And then I got the realization, oh, this is different than other things in that I can, and other people are sensing it before I do. It's percolating into my psyche. It's doing the vertical. And it's also transferring broadly and deeply in my life. And that's where I first got the idea of that's how we should evaluate. And then I saw Jennings making very convergent arguments. That's the rationale. That's the normative standard by which we judge how good a ritual is, right? So I think the martial arts, the problem with the martial arts is they're in a chaotic place right now. So we had the martial arts way over here, and there was a lot, it got really bad, it got really corrupted, and that's the right word, with Wu, with a lot of Wu stuff. And then there was the MMA reaction, which is cut away all that Wu and make me really good at killing people in a fight. And there was a disciplining that came in. The problem, and I've talked with Rodney King about this, right, he's also a martial artist, is we've lost how the martial art, if the only reason I was doing a martial art is so I'm in a situation where I have to defend myself, it is a waste of time because I've had to do it like once in my life. And even when you win, you lose. It takes away a piece of your soul. That's not the primary reason to, right? The primary reason to do it is the cultivation of wisdom. So we need to bring the pendulum back here. Yes, the Wu was bad, and it got really bad, and it was charlatans and exploitative, and it was corrupt. This has been a good corrective, but now it's overcorrective. We need to bring it back, and then if it gets back there, then the relationship between martial arts and philosophy, I think, would be an extremely valuable thing to recommend to people in general.
Can I say something about Mr. Miyagi as well? Just because I think Mr. Miyagi in the Karate Kid movie is a great example of symbolic integration, you could call it. And it has to do with this idea of faith, that the way that I tried to talk about faith, which is that Mr. Miyagi has him do a bunch of things that don't seem related to each other. And he says, trust me. Right? So it's like, you're too stupid. You can't see beyond anyways. So just do this stuff and trust me, have faith. And that at some point that faith, well, that's what happens in the movie. At some point he gets a revelation where all of a sudden he it's revealed to him the reason for all the things he was doing in the first place. And so he jumps one level of integration. And I think that's a great example of understanding how symbolic insight works and how symbolic insight is practical. It's not just something that happens in your mind. It is that kind of jump up of when you get insight into how multiplicity fits together. That's what Mr. Miyagi does in that movie.
And that's like inevitable when you're doing a martial art, when the martial art isn't just kick and punch. You get, like, you're doing all this stuff and you don't know why you're doing it. You really don't, and you have to trust. But you get this realization, you get this revelation, right? And you go, oh, right, yeah, for sure. I think that, and because it's embodied, it's accessible for many people in a way in which intellectual and more philosophical senses of that anagoge are not available to them.
What are types of practices and postures that we could practice without having reached that higher level that would prepare us for that jump up? I think you all will have a lot to say about that.
No, but that's what the whole the whole Christian practice. That's what it's for. That's what daily prayers are for. That's what going to church is. That's what the, especially in the Orthodox tradition, that's what the Jesus prayer is for, you know. And so with the Jesus prayer is just one sentence. You just say it over and over and over and over, and you think, what's a, I mean, that could seem like a ridiculous thing. But the, it's the idea that in some ways, all you can do is make yourself available for that insight. You can't force it. It doesn't happen on its own. And so, you know, emptying the space of your thoughts, you know, just capturing your thoughts, preventing them from taking up the space, opens up the possibility for, you know, that vertical ascent. And so there are all these, like all the Christian practices are for that. Repentance, you know, communion, all of this is so that you can...
But Jonathan, are you envisioning that to be available to anyone at any time?
The Jesus prayer?
No,
I mean, it's pretty simple. It's just one sentence. Say it all the time, though.
Orthodox practices, the rituals of the church, the Orthodox practices, the way of Orthodoxy, and the way that it has been passed on over the centuries. Would you consider that to be an accessible set of rituals and practices?
You mean for people, let's say, in America?
Yeah,
a random
bunch of people, like the average person in the room.
I think so.
This room?
Yeah, in this room. For sure, this room. Yeah, for sure.
That's a bit of sampling
bias,
right?
All right. Sorry I said that. I've been wrong before.
Yeah.
So another group, the average audience in a football stadium.
I think so. I mean, I think so. But for the same reason that the average group in the football team would go to church on a Sunday, you know, I think all these things are still available to us. Yeah. It's true that liturgical practice needs training. At first, you don't know what's going on. It's the same as Mr. Miyagi, and I get that all the time. You know, someone says, I'd like to go visit an Orthodox church. They walk in, and for them, it's like an hour and a half, and I don't know what's going on, and he keeps saying, and again, and again, and again, and the prayers, you know, and you don't know, it seems to have no rhyme or reason, but you kind of have to imbibe it, and at some point you see the deep structure that you're participating in. But you're right, it's not readily available to people in the sense that if you went in, that for the same reason martial arts is also not readily available to people, because if you just walk into a martial arts class and you think you're going to be able to do it, you get beaten up.
So before we came upon the concept of estuary, Paul and I talked about an image of what kind of thing we might be talking about when we wanted to rebrand the Jordan Peterson meetup groups. Mm-hmm. And there was some conversation, including at this church, conversations on the edge. And but then we also had some talk about the outer court.
Yeah, the narthex.
So we thought about outer court ministry. It's, you know, as soon as you put the word outer in there, then it's kind of alienating, and you kind of identify people as out and out there.
Yeah.
But nevertheless, the Bible describes the structure of the temple as consisting of the Holy of Holies, the holy, and the outer court.
Yeah.
So there is a sense in which there is something structurally anticipated about how close to the holy can we actually come easily, and how the very structure of the temple facilitated some kind of a non-committal approach. Mm-hmm. So you can kind of hang out here with, you know, the real religious people are out there,
yeah,
but the rest of us, we can be here and even engage in some commerce, you know, sell some lambs and t-shirts and, you know, that kind of thing.
But you know that traditional church has the same structure. So right. Traditional church has the sanctuary, the nave, the narthex, and sometimes an exonarthex, which is called, and the narthex is an intermediary space. And so traditionally in the first centuries, there were two parts to the liturgy, the liturgy of the word and the liturgy of the faithful. And at the end of the liturgy of the word, they would chase out the non-baptized into the narthex. And then the non-baptized will go into the narthex and they would receive instruction. There would be something for them there, but there was this sense that they're still in the intermediary space. And the recognition of that intermediary space, I think, is very useful for us now, because most of us are in that intermediary space for many, many things. Like most of us are monsters. Most of us are like kind of halflings or, you know, hybrids of some kind, because the world is made that way. So understanding that hybrid space or that intermediary space is important. In some of the Greek churches, above the door from the narthex out into the outside, that's where you would have the icon of St. Christopher, right, the dog-headed man. And this, for the same reason that you have the gargoyles and all these types of hybrid creatures on the edge, you know, the understand. And estuary is an amazing name for what you're doing. I think it's a beautiful way of capturing exactly that. Without, because you've used the word narthex, nobody knows what that is. Like, nobody knows what the narthex is.
Oh, we have the same problem with estuary, trust me.
Oh, estuary is weird enough.
What is an estuary?
But it leads into the image.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, yesterday we talked about science, the reintegration of science, but it goes much deeper than just science, because, you know, part of what bursts out in the Protestant Reformation, because these issues are very real in Protestantism. You can read Charles Taylor. He talks about one speed versus two speed. The goal of, let's say, Calvin in Geneva was to create a holy city, and it was the question of the margins that continued to bedevil Calvin in Geneva, the Puritans in New England. But at the same time, part of what these great tensions within Christianity, you see them already in Christ. You have one master, and all of you are brothers. Wow. Flat. And you get that with science, of course. It's a flat ontology. Everything is accessible from a monarchical point of view, which you sort of self-transcend. That's how we see the world, a world of objects. I mean, these tensions are in church, these tensions are in politics, they're in knowing. And I mean, in many ways, that's exactly what we're working through now. And when I talk about, you know, when the protest ends, which, again, we're working on time frames far longer than any of our lives, but these are the tensions we are working through. And part of why I'm so excited about this conference is, again, we're doing this in this room, and I asked someone this morning, could we do this in an Orthodox church? It's like, well, what room? Because this is an auditorium. Just look around, it's an auditorium. What we're going to see at the Orthodox Church is, that's a very different space. And the arena, you know, you've got this relationship, so.
Yeah, it's a good, that's why we have usually they'll have a church hall, like that's where.
Right.
But it's true that having a conversation like this in the nave might make many, many people uncomfortable. Definitely, yeah.
So, I'd like to answer this question, because it's one towards which I'm devoting a lot of thought with other people like Taylor. Sort of 3Ds about practices, sort of three dimensions, and then four domains, and then design principles. So dimensions. The dimensions are, make sure your practices are addressing view, care, and action. So make sure, like, view is this orientation, action, and how you're caring. So people tend to focus on one of the dimensions to the exclusion of the others, but try and get all three dimensions. Those are sort of the three dimensions of wisdom. And I've been privileged to participate in the scientific consensus paper about wisdom, all the scientists sort of, what are the core features, and also all the practitioners. And this is Nathan Vanderpool and Taylor and others are, but this idea that make sure you're addressing the three dimensions, view, care, and action. The four domains in which you should have practices are dime. You should have dialogical practices, imaginal practices, mindfulness practices, and embodiment practices. And we've been all talking about that. And of course, there are many practices that will overlap and bridge between them. And then that gets you into the design principles. And this is the idea of an ecology of practices. I'm still at work at this, but it's drawn from participant observation, both within and then also looking at the existing legacy religions. I hope that's not an insult term. I don't mean it to be an insult term. I want some way of calling them world religions is a little bit imperious. And so some of the design principles are, you want opponent processing because that's how your cognition works. Like, so for example, you want a meditative practice that moves in, you want a contemplative practice that moves out, so zooming in and zooming out are, right, counterbalanced with each other. You want stillness practices, and you want movement practices. But so you're looking for opponent processing because that allows you to find the trade-off relationships. It allows you to more properly conform. We've been talking all through this conference about the trade-off relationships inherent in reality. Opponent processing is the deep conformity principle. You get opponent what happens in relevance realization is there's trade-off relationships in reality, and the predictive processing self-organizes to appropriate and capitalize on those through opponent processing. And so you want opponent processing to give you the greatest possibility of conforming to a reality that will challenge you out of just doing it because you like it and comfort zone, et cetera, et cetera. You want layering. You want like a practice. You can start with something that's just follow the breath or just do the Jesus prayer. And then that can get taken up into a more advanced. And they can get taken up. And you also want bridging principles. You want, right, so you've got meditative practices over here, and you have contemplative, you have sort of psychotherapeutic practice, and people can do, like, there's what's called subtle body work or other kinds of things that bridge between these practices. I don't think that has completely gelled the way the first two have, but I think it's on the way. But if you address the three dimensions, and you have an ecology that's in the four domains, dime, and remember, doing both rituals and practices in dime, so you do individual practices, you need to do collective rituals for all of those things. And then I think if you have the design principles of opponent processing, layering, and bridging then that's a good. So I'm actually presenting to you right now a pedagogical theory, right? This is a good pedagogy of how to enter into the cultivation of wisdom. And so don't start with what is accessible to you. Just make sure you're addressing the dimensions, the domains, and the design principles. And then it will, and don't just do practices, do rituals. And if you do that, I think this is a pedagogy that will help you to start at a very low level and scale into something more advanced. I do think, by the way, that I see this pedagogy in the legacy religions, like I say. And so I don't think I'm imposing anything. I'm trying to exact from that and also from what I see in all these emerging communities and try and give what could we offer people as a pedagogy? So that's my offering. You are offering places and history and tradition and community and an established ecology of practices. I'm trying to say, yeah, but what is needed, maybe for many people, is a pedagogical account of how do people get drawn into, educed and educated within this.
So I was listening very carefully, and this opponent processing, now,
not adversarial process.
I understand, but are we saying that if we promote fasting in the church, should we then also promote feasting?
Yes.
In the church?
Of course.
Because my mind goes through food all the time.
Yes.
Really?
If you were just to fast, it would at some point it starts to self-organize in like
emptiness.
Yeah, and a self-perpetuation. Yeah. And if you're just a feast, it can, you know, sort of. Yeah, you can. Yeah, right? Yeah, into gluttony. But if you're trading, if you're constantly trading between them, think about what that gives you. Think about, even dropping out of the religious framework. So it's there. I'm just dropping down to a lower adaptive framework. That gives you an optimal grip on your relationship to food.
Yeah. Thank you for that.
I'd like to also say that one of the things that I've been thinking a lot lately and haven't quite figured out how to language yet is sort of the modern imagination. Mm. And it's been touched on a number of times these last 2 days that you can do all, and You can do all the things. So I approach this as a pastor, and, you know, so we do all the things in church. And so you've got this person that they're baptized correctly, they were catechized correctly, they participated correctly. You know, there's been no obvious gross sin, distortion, addiction, none of that. And then you still look for the fruit, and it's, is the fruit there? Not sure. And then you look at another, and, you know, let's say a saint's coming out of horrible backgrounds and flourish. And so I think part of the modern imagination is the instrumentality that if we can create the system, whether it's a religious system or pedagogical system or scientific system, we can ensure the outcome. And I think, especially when we talk about the quest for a spiritual home, I see this all the time in churches. You do all the right things, and then there's collapse. And why, Lord? Why? We did all the right things. And so you, and I think both of you have been saying it through this conference. There's the things below, but it's all setting up to receive. Of course. And to the degree that you have a spiritual home that is flourishing, it's a gift. And so that posture is so vital of we're not ensuring. The modern imagination is to control and to totalize. And this posture has always been, this is a posture of receiving. So.
I think that's absolutely right. And this is why I have consistently used the word ecology rather than system. It has to be a living thing that takes on a life of its own. And that's why but you can still look at the dimensions, the domains, and the design principles of an ecology, but you have to remember it's an ecology and not a system. Very, very, very much so. See, I did three varies instead of three no's.
So that meme was...
If you were to consider the classic virtues, what would the postures be of those virtues?
So do we mean the four cardinal virtues and the three theological virtues? Is the seven sort of standard virtues? Well, there's more virtues. I think Woodruff has made a very good argument for reverence being a lost virtue that we need to recover. I think our culture emphasizes awe. And I've been running an experiment with other people at the University of Toronto, Jennifer Steller, Michelle Ferrari, Junsun Kim. Awe on itself doesn't seem to do much. And this may be an argument for why worship, by the way. So, because originally they thought, oh, well, what awe, why we like awe? Because we like awe, because it's weird. Because usually awe, the sense of self diminishes, and usually we don't like experiences in which, but the thing about awe is it's weird because I almost disappeared and that was wonderful, right? It's like, what's going on there? And then the standard, Keltner, just got a book out on awe coming out, and I'm going to meet him in a conference in July, and I'll get to talk to him about this directly. Well, it's all it is it's like accommodation. You're growing in awe. And so, you know, I know what Piaget means by accommodation, and accommodation means massive frame breaking, and you're right, and you're doing this. So there should be massive increase in cognitive flexibility. So we ran an experiment, put people into an awe. We have reliable awe induction practice things, put them in, and then give them cognitive flexibility tests. No increase in cognitive flexibility after awe. It looks like what has to happen is there has to be another stage in which that is appropriated in reverence. There has to be a stage beyond the awe of humiliation in the sense that Jonathan and I were talking about, that becomes then a calling,
yeah,
right, to you. The awe itself is just an experience. So virtue is the appropriate, reverence is the appropriate virtue for awe. So I just want to make it clear that there's a lot of virtues that we need to bring back into the discussion. And I don't know, if each one of us goes through all seven, that's going to be a very long time. I'll say one thing. So I think Socrates is right that there's a unity to the virtues. Now that has typically been understood as an interdependence, and I don't think that's wrong, but I think that's insufficient. I think that doesn't have the leap up that Jonathan talks about. I would propose to you that every virtue, think of that virtue originally, it's an excellence and it's a power. It's not just moral, being moral, right? And that's why we still say in virtue of. The fire, I lit the fire in virtue of the oxygen, right? Every virtue is a way of fitting in your wisdom to a situation. It's every virtue is the way to be wise in that situation. Kindness is how to be wise in that situation. And you can see why it has a wisdom element into it, because being wise to Jonathan is very different from how I'm wise to my beloved partner, Sarah. If I was kind to her in the way I was kind to him, that's weird. And if I was kind to my son the way I am to Sarah, that's bizarre. And if I'm kind to my student, like, you see, you can't capture kindness. And this is the great mistake that we've tried since Kant. We'll capture virtues and rules, and then we have Locke. Oh my God, sorry, right? And then what we'll do is we'll capture the rules in laws, and that's how we'll make everybody virtuous. We'll reduce the virtues to rules, and we'll reduce the rules to law, and all we have to do is make more and more laws, and eventually utopia will ensue. And I think this is a grand mistake. Instead, right, I want to propose to you that every virtue is a way of doing powerful relevance realization so that you are best fitted to be as wise as you possibly can in that situation. I think it's emotional maturity, but it's more than emotional maturity, because I think it's also a cognitive maturity. I think it's also an existential maturity. I think it's also an energetic maturity. Many people have not educated the energetic aspect of their being. They have not properly educated, matured. I like mature better. Have not matured. Maturity is like sophrosyne. It's one of those meta virtues. In every virtue, you should be maturing. In every virtue, you should be doing sophrosyne. Sophrosyne is you're regulating your behavior, not like this. I won't partake of that. That's enkratia. Sophrosyne is, that doesn't matter to me because I'm really tempted by the true, the good, and the beautiful. And so every virtue should be doing that. So I think all the virtues are maturing all of the aspects of what we are as persons. You have to get social maturity too. This has been a great challenge for me. A great, great challenge for me. I'm in many ways, still remain, but I've been addressing it literally for decades. I'm socially inept. There'll still be situations. So many of you are just like, I admire that about you. I have this whole, like, it's like the tech booth where there's all these people running the scripts about, do this, do this, do this, because this, or else you'll seem like either a potted plant or somebody from Venus, right? I've had to build that deliberately, right? And still, we'll come home from a situation and I'm sort of, yay. And Sarah goes, why did you do that? And I'll go, what did I do? Right? So I think
that's all of us, though. I have to say.
Well, maybe.
Don't worry.
Okay. Well, that's a function. A function of something else, John.
Okay, maybe. But I have a personal proclivity that is perhaps exacerbated. But the point I'm making is, I think all of the virtues are about all of the dimensions of personhood maturing. Where maturing, I think John Rusin is right. And look at the language. Maturity is your ability to face reality. And face, and think about everything we've been talking about, the ability, till we have faces. It's the ability to face reality. And so this is, for example, this is how courage is different from foolhardiness. The fool and the coward are not facing reality, right? But the courageous person is able to face reality, even in their fear. They can face reality. And that's, And it's also courageous if that is what is required at the time. Like, you don't want to always be courageous. Sometimes what's needed is compassion, not courage. Right? So that's what I have to say about the virtue. That's the Socratic proposal.
Thank you. Lunch is ready, so we should all head out. Oh, I'll let you go.